are going to have a common enemy. And in this environment, I think Iran would be able to resist the pressures easier than when you had American hegemony taking over the whole world. So overall, I think the future is bright, and the country is not only going to survive, I think Iran is going to be one of the major countries of the 21st century.
Okay, and unfortunately, I have to end the program, but I appreciate talking to both of you. We're out of time. Dr. Fuad Izzat, the university professor and political analyst out of Tehran. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on Another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa laqad ba'athna fi kulli ummatin rasulan an i'budullaha wajtanibut taghut. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين وأقسموا بالله جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raised in every nation an apostle, saying, serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejecters. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him, quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Hamas warns there's no safe place for Israeli forces in the occupied territories after an explosive device injures four of the regime's soldiers. The U.S. approves a new military aid package for Taiwan despite China's repeated strong warnings against such moves. And the Gabon junta names a former head of the Presidential Guard as the country's transition leader following the coup there. Our top story for this half hour, at least four Israeli soldiers have been injured after an explosive device went off as they raided the eastern part of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. According to Israeli military, the injured troops included an officer. They raided the area to protect Israeli settlers who stormed it to visit a historical monument. The regime's forces used live fire and tear gas against Palestinians, injuring nearly 60 people. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade has claimed responsibility for the blast. A spokesman for Hamas resistance movement said the blast was a resounding message to Israeli extremist cabinet that its forces will not be safe anywhere in the occupied territories. It added that Israeli forces will be hit with more explosive devices if they continue terrorizing the peaceful Palestinian people. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian driver after they allegedly ran over three soldiers in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. We're now joined by our correspondent, Mona Kandil, for an update on the incident. Mona, what details do you have to share with us?
It claimed that a Palestinian arrived driving his vehicle at the Beit Sira military checkpoint near Ramallah, and he hit Israeli soldiers where they're wounding at least three Israeli soldiers. One of them is in serious condition. Israeli troops opened fire at this Palestinian man, and now we are receiving, according to the Israeli military, it seems that this Palestinian had succumbed to his injuries. We have to wait until to make sure that he was killed. However, the Israeli military initially said that they shot and killed a Palestinian, rammed his vehicle at Israeli forces at the military checkpoint of Beit Sira near Ramallah. Since the beginning of this year, we are speaking about 230 Palestinians had been killed by the Israeli forces in the occupied territories. And at the same time, this number includes at least 40 or even more than 40 Palestinian minors. Yesterday, a Palestinian child, 14-year-old Palestinian, was shot and killed in the Misrara city, the Misrara town in Al-Quds, claiming that he tried to stab Israeli forces. The Israeli aggression continues, as you were saying. Israeli troops raided Nablus, and every day Israeli forces raid Palestinian areas, claiming that they want to arrest Palestinians wanted for security reasons. A number of people are being shot or arrested, if not being killed by the Israeli troops. And that's why the resistance groups continue to say that the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves, that if there is more anti-Israeli operations or ramming, then it would be natural response from the Palestinians to respond to the atrocities and aggression being committed by the Israeli forces against the Palestinians here.
Mona, let's also focus on two issues. One, the response coming from the Palestinian resistance groups, such as Hamas. They've lauded the operations that the Palestinians are carrying out against Israelis as a natural response to the increased Israeli aggression and the occupation. Unpack that for us. Also, if you may, address the issue of the international silence, the international community silence with regards to the continued day-to-day violence that's being carried out against Palestinians by the Israeli regime.
Hamas movement issued a statement yesterday following the Israeli military raid to Nablus, and to say that Palestinians have the right to defend themselves, that Palestinian fighters continue to exist in Nablus, in Jenin, in Tulkarem, in other areas and parts of the occupied West Bank. And if they resist, they have the right to resist. When the Palestinian fighters hurled explosive devices at the Israeli troops and their armored vehicles, then it's a natural response when the Israeli military continues to use excessive force and killing people in cold blood. So other Palestinian resistance groups have the same thoughts, that as long as the Israeli military raids Palestinian areas, arrest people, destroy their homes, and kill people in cold blood, then Palestinians have the right to resist themselves, to face the Israeli crimes until bringing this Israeli occupation to an end. Speaking about the international silence, unfortunately, Palestinians know very well that they are fed up from urging the international community to move, to hold the Israeli authorities and the Israeli regime accountable for their crimes. When it comes to Palestinians, they know that there is an international silence and nothing would happen. The international community might only condemn the Israeli, not even crimes, the Israeli activities against the Palestinians, but at the same time, they do not hold them accountable for these atrocities and illegal practices.
Thanks a lot. Mona Kandil joining us from Ramallah. That's where millions of Muslims from across the world are converging on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala to commemorate Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. People from all walks of life are marching toward the holy city, most notably from Iran. Last year, more than 3.5 million Iranians took part in the walk. Senior Iranian government officials have made multiple visits to the border crossings in recent days to ensure the smooth passage for pilgrims to and from Iraq. Experts say it's an endeavor to keep alive the movement of Karbala, which is a movement against terrorism, fascism, and despotism. Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD while fighting courageously for justice against the much larger army of then tyrant ruler Yazid. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has approved a new military aid package for Taiwan, under the Foreign Military Financing Program. The move is expected to raise China's ire, as the program is normally used for countries recognized as sovereign states. The measure was taken through a notification sent to Congress that informed congressional committees that the State Department intends to obligate up to $80 million in funds to support Taiwan. The funds will be used to boost Taiwan's self-defense capabilities and enhance its maritime security. Beijing has repeatedly warned against any official exchanges between Washington and Taipei. China has also slammed the U.S. for providing military aid to the island. Last month, the U.S. announced a Taiwan weapons aid package worth up to about $350 million. The United States has had nearly 500 mass shootings this year alone, as they speed towards a new record. However, many in low-income neighborhoods complain that gun violence in their communities goes ignored and untreated. Rami Mazuri has more from Chicago.
Record annual pace for mass shootings, averaging two such incidents every day this year. High summer temperatures, soaring economic inequality, a nation awash in guns, and with lax supervision over them, there seems to be a universal belief that the epidemic of mass shootings won't decline anytime soon. But there is increasing anger over which mass shootings get political attention and which do not. Every day, 120 Americans are killed with guns, and more than 200 are shot and wounded. But the recent murder of three black people in Florida by a white racist was immediately seized upon by the political classes, even though domestic far-right extremists killed just 25 people last year.
As I made clear in my inaugural address, white supremacy is a poison. It's a poison. It's been allowed to grow faster and fester in our communities, to the point where the intelligence community is determined, the U.S. intelligence community is determined that domestic terrorism rooted in white supremacy is the greatest terrorist threat we face in the homeland.
Shootings at schools also get massive attention, but what goes repeatedly ignored are the victims at the most common site of debilitating gun violence, poor neighborhoods.
It's a tragedy when these things are happening, but when those things happen, they usually happen in these white schools in these rich neighborhoods. They're getting funding, they're getting support. The media is talking about it. The world cares about gun safety. But we're talking about it on a daily basis, and no one cares. I had a 13-year-old say, I carry a gun to school because I want to make it there safely, not because I want to hurt somebody. I think that speaks volume for a 13-year-old to be able to say something like that. And I think those are the situations and stories that need to be told, and those are the ones that need to be invested in, and how are we able to make that shift and make that happen?
Gun control is a constant media topic, but there is almost no discussion about the economic and social redistribution programs which have been proven to reduce mass shootings in poor areas.
The investment is not going in the right spaces. They invest so much, so heavily on the policing aspect of it, and they've done that for decades, and it's repeatedly proven to not work or make a difference. Building community together. Getting God up to there, they never seen, taking them off the block, taking them other spaces, and investing that money and putting money in their pockets and teaching them skills at the same time. And that's the aspect and component that's missing.
The U.S. gun homicide rate is 26 times that of other high-income countries. Their economic inequality is the highest of any nation in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the so-called Club of Rich Countries. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Turning now to Gabon, where the junta says it has named General Brice Oligui Nguema as the leader of the transition in the country following the military takeover there. Nguema is a former head of the country's presidential guard. This after a group of military officers earlier said they put President Ali Bongo under house arrest and seized power. It happened after the Central African States election body announced Bongo had won a third term in a controversial vote. The officers claimed the election was not credible. They said they represented the armed forces. The vote was set to extend the Bongo family's more than half a century in power. On Wednesday, the junta announced a nightly curfew until further notice. 4 months into the Sudan conflict, and there is still no end in sight to the deadly violence there. The fighting, which started in mid-April, has now expanded to other cities and regions, including South Darfur, where in a recent attack, some 40 people, most of them civilians, were killed. The violence has prompted Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan to seek regional help in an effort to bring the deadly conflict to an end.
Fierce fighting rages on in Sudan, more than 4 months into the deadly conflict between the country's regular army, headed by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF, led by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. In the latest development, nearly 40 people, most of them women and children, including multiple members of several families, were killed in shelling of Niala, a city in South Darfur. The escalation of violence prompted Burhan to take an Egypt trip to discuss a way out of the deadly crisis with his Egyptian counterpart Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. In the meeting, Sisi reaffirmed Egypt's firm position in standing by Sudan and supporting its security, stability, and territorial integrity. The visit marked the first time Burhan left Sudan since the April 15th start of the conflict, which broke out amid discord over plans to integrate their troops into a single force as part of a transition to democracy. Burhan and Sisi discussed the Egyptian president's offer to mediate the conflict, an initiative Burhan has welcomed. During his trip to Egypt, Burhan also talked of a transitional period to hand over power to a civilian rule.
We are keen to put an end to this war and put an end to this tragedy. We in the army, in the Sudanese armed forces, are committed to establish a real transitional period after which the Sudanese people can establish their state through free and fair elections in which they choose whom they want to be governed by.
Sudan's army chief accused the paramilitaries of committing war crimes during the conflict.
We in Sudan, as it is known, are facing a devastating war carried out by rebel groups that use everything that could destroy the Sudanese people. These groups practice the most heinous types of crimes that could be classified as war crimes in Khartoum, Al-Junayna, Niala, and in various parts of Sudan.
The RSF has denied the allegations, but has said that any of its fighters found involved in abuses would be brought to justice. The regular army is also accused of fighting in residential areas, indiscriminately firing heavy weapons, which has resulted in hundreds of civilians killed in the capital and other major cities. Fighting has also cut off phone networks, electricity, and humanitarian aid for weeks in several parts of the country, with tens of thousands of residents trapped.
Well, the United Nations has already warned of catastrophic consequences if the war between the army and paramilitary forces in Sudan continues, with nearly 5,000 people being killed and more than 4.5 million displaced. The international community needs to play a more positive role to prevent the Sudan crisis from exacerbating further.
The fighting in Sudan brings to the spotlight the humanitarian situation in Northeast African nation. Conservative estimates from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project show that nearly 5,000 people have been killed in the more than 4 months conflict. The real figure, however, is believed to be much higher. The United Nations says more than 4.6 million people have been displaced by the fighting both inside and outside Sudan. The humanitarian crisis there has escalated since the conflict between the army and the RSF began. According to UN figures, only in Niala, South Darfur, more than 50,000 people have fled their homes due to the violence since August 11. This has prompted UN officials to voice deep concern over the situation in Sudan.
We've just issued a statement on Sudan from Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths. It contains a stark warning from the UN's humanitarian chief that war and hunger could consume Sudan if those fighting in this conflict do not put the people of Sudan above their pursuit of power and resources.
The UN official also warned that the humanitarian crisis in Sudan can spread to the entire region.
A protracted conflict in Sudan could tip the entire region into a humanitarian catastrophe.
The official also warned that hundreds of thousands of malnourished children could die if they do not receive treatment.
The longer this fighting continues, the more devastating its impact is going to be. Hundreds of thousands of children are already severely malnourished and at imminent risk of death if left untreated. Millions more will have their education replaced by the devastating traumas of war, becoming a lost generation.
The warning comes as the United Nations has already called on warring sides in Sudan to respect international law, protect civilians, and stop targeting relief and aid workers. This indicates that the humanitarian situation in Sudan is almost on the verge of collapse. That, however, seems to be of least significance for the leaders of the parties to the conflict in Sudan. Quite contrary, though, what should be of very high significance is for the international community to push for a lasting ceasefire in Sudan that would ultimately prevent a further exacerbation of the humanitarian situation there.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor, give prophets on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
French authorities are to ban the wearing in school of abaya dresses worn by some Muslim women. Unlike headscarves banned in schools in 2004, the abaya, a garment worn to comply with Islamic beliefs on modest dress, had faced no outright ban until now. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye noted, France will ban children from wearing the abaya, the loose-fitting, full-length robes worn by some Muslim women in state-run schools. Its education minister said recently ahead of schools returning after the summer holidays. France, which has enforced a strict ban on religious signs in state schools since 19th century laws, removed any traditional Catholic influence from public education, has struggled to update guidelines to deal with a growing Muslim minority. In 2004, France banned the wearing of signs or outfits by which students ostensibly show a religious affiliation in schools, like Islamic headscarves. In 2010, it passed a ban on full-face veils in public, angering many of its 5 million-strong Muslim community. Unlike headscarves, the abaya, a garment worn to comply with Islamic beliefs on modest dress, occupied a gray area and faced no outright ban until now. Defending secularism is a rallying cry in France that resonates across the political spectrum, from left-wingers upholding the liberal values of the Enlightenment to far-right voters seeking a bulwark against the growing role of Islam in French society. Education Minister Gabriel Attal said in an interview with TV channel TF1, "I have decided that the abaya could no longer be worn in schools." He claimed, "Secularism means the freedom to emancipate oneself through school." He continued describing the abaya as a religious gesture aimed at testing the resistance of the Republic towards the secular sanctuary that the school must constitute. He claimed, "When you walk into a classroom, you shouldn't be able to identify the pupil's religion just by looking at them." According to RT, schoolgirls in France will be banned from wearing the abaya, a full-length Islamic robe, in state schools starting from September. The education minister announced recently, arguing that the garment violates laws on secular education. The issue has long been debated in France amid claims that abayas worn in schools cause tensions between teachers and parents. A 2004 French law prohibits items of clothing that ostensibly show a religious affiliation in schools, such as Islamic headscarves. The ban has received criticisms even in France. Left-wing politicians have slammed the measure as Islamophobic. Clémentine Autain, a lawmaker from the La France, Isomis, or France Unbound Party, called it unconstitutional and a sign of the obsessive rejection of Muslims. According to Anadolu news agency, France is home to Europe's largest Muslim population. However, discrimination in the country is pushing many highly skilled Muslim professionals to seek better job opportunities in more tolerant societies accepting of their religious beliefs. A new study by the University of Lille, led by Professor Olivier Steves, revealed that highly educated Muslims are leaving France in large numbers for the UK, US, Canada, and Dubai. After surveying 1,074 Muslims who left the country, Steves argues that more than two-thirds of reported people, they moved to practice their religion more freely, while 70% said they left to avoid incidents of racism and discrimination. Steve suggested that Muslim professionals with in-demand skills are fed up with the way they are treated in the country. Steve's pointed out, what's ironic is that France pays for these people's education, yet the country loses that highly skilled talent because of rampant institutional Islamophobia. Natasa Jetovic, finance project manager, moved to the UK from France in 2020 in the hope to be able to practice her religion more easily and being offered better job opportunities that match her skills. Her decision to move paid off, as since she moved to London, she has been promoted several times and is now earning double. She has experienced racist remarks at a leading French bank, where she was threatened by her manager to be fired for confronting and accusing her colleagues of discrimination. She said, people would use racist terms and then I would ask them to stop, and from that moment onwards, nobody wanted to have lunches with me. Nobody wanted to talk to me for the next 6 months. I was just under boycotts. She is one of the many highly skilled Muslim professionals who do not feel welcome in France, and for that reason are taking their skills where they feel are more appreciated. Yasser Louati, a French political analyst and human rights advocate who is currently the head of the Committee for Justice and Liberties, told Anadolu news agency that the lack of religious freedom has become a reason why Muslim professionals are leaving France. Louati argues that France loses highly skilled talent because of widespread institutional Islamophobia and that the sole loser here is France. Those who leave France are essentially trained and educated in France through public funding, which means that there is no return on investments and instead the rival economies are profiting from those with a rich background, both in terms of their education and culturally, he said. He added, so one has to ask, how smart are our policymakers to let these people leave the country and work for economies in a globalized world where France is becoming a lame duck? When you discriminate, you push people toward exile, but I don't think leaving is the answer. It is also about confronting these policies. According to him, Muslims living in France are discriminated against in the terms of education, getting a job, purchasing a house, or even sometimes getting access to healthcare. The national policymakers would rather miss out on opportunities that allow people to be their equals. It's too bad for France. And honestly, I salute those countries and those companies that give a fair chance to these young men and women. Since 2015, the French government has adopted various laws that Muslims say restrict their religious freedoms, including a law that was passed in 2016 that prohibits the wearing of hijab at work. While in 2017, French President Emmanuel Macron and his centrist government passed legislation that puts imams under harsh government security. The government has also shut down mosques, Muslim-led groups, charities, and nonprofits without due process. Luati further pointed out that such policies have created a culture of hostility that, in turn, are responsible for the rise of Islamophobia in France. The negative Muslim portrayal in France media was intensified during 2022 presidential campaign by far-right candidates Marine Le Pen and Eric Zemmour, who dedicated much of their election campaign to the threats of Islam, as they claimed. A 2016 study revealed that a fifth of all instances of Islamophobia in France happens in the work environment. According to a 2021 government report, job applicants with the Muslim Arab sounding names have a 32% less chance of being called in for an interview. Islamophobia in France is more prevalent because it is more visible. However, this does not mean that other Western governments are better, Luati said, adding, if we take a look at what the UK is doing to their Muslims or what Italy is doing or what, for example, the US is doing, there is no big difference. However, even if their policies tend to be somehow radical, there are still more opportunities for Muslims there than in France. Muslims are fully aware that they cannot completely escape prejudice in the West. However, the discrimination at the workplace or in general is more visible and less sophisticated in France. Luati said, Muslims are trying their very best. Muslims are here to stay, like it or not. Muslims have been here before you and they will be here after you.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Light polluted skies.
Part 1.
It's an earthquake and I'm in my house. Everything is falling apart. I have the door. I don't know what to do.
Ma'am, just stay calm.
I need the fire department in my apartment. The water is coming out to the back room.
The 1994 Northridge earthquake was a moment magnitude 6.7 MW blind thrust earthquake that occurred on January 17, 1994 at 4:30 and 55 a.m. This earthquake
damaged more than 40,000 buildings, triggered landslides in some areas, and also caused nationwide blackouts. The whole city went dark.
What I can say is we've just experienced a real whopper here, especially here at the radio station. We're trying to piece everything together.
Camped out over there on the football field there. Now, what you're seeing now is an apartment complex right near here. This kind of gives you an idea of how there's sporadic lighting. Some have lighting, some don't. And look out in the parking lot. There is lighting here now, plenty of lighting, and yet these people are camped outside.
Maybe you've got the kids here. How many youngsters?
Three.
And do they sort of take it in stride, or is it fun, or does it get to be
a kid? So for them, it's fun, but for us, the parents, it's a job. It's hard work, and we're freezing. It's cold out here, so we're looking forward to this all being over and life getting back to normal.
People were afraid of the aftershocks and thieves who could steal from their homes in the darkness. So they left their warm homes and went to the cold streets of Northridge. These people could remember that 17 years before Northridge earthquake, two bolts of lightning that robbed New York City of its electricity and turned it into a darkened island for 25 hours. The blackout caused chaos throughout the city. At 9:34 p.m. on July 13, 1977, New York City went dark. In the ensuing 25 hours that the city was without electricity, thousands of places were set on fire, 1,600 stores were looted, people were murdered, women were assaulted, and criminals took bloody revenge with hot and cold weapons. During the blackout, the traffic lights didn't operate, and the number of car accidents was expected to increase. At this same time, people didn't respect rules, regulations, and social control, while CCTV cameras and anti-theft systems were turned off. New York was drowned into chaos. There was still anarchy in the city by sunrise. A group of rebels stole each and every inexpensive thing from shops and people's homes in New York. Hospitals and medical centers, as well as detention centers and prisons, were full of people during that 25-hour blackout in New York. In the largest mass arrest in U.S. history, more than 3,700 people were detained. By the end of the blackout, around 4,500 looters were arrested and 550 police officers were injured.
Direct from CBS News, this special Radio Net Alert news report.
A major power blackout has hit New York City and surrounding communities.
Chuck, if you could, what can you tell us about the feel for Midtown Manhattan?
Well, George, there are people directing traffic at the intersections. I assume many of them are policemen. Some of them, obviously, are just volunteers, people who wanted to pitch in.
After 17 years from New York City blackout of 1977, Northridge earthquake occurred on January 17, 1994. This situation didn't have any similarities with the stagflation in the 1970s and hooligans and gangsters in the 1950s. The period of growth and prosperity of the United States of America was after the Persian Gulf War and access to the oil resources of West Asia. The Northridge earthquake left 20,000 homeless in that dark and cold night. People were in a state of panic. People were terrified of the increase in the number of thefts, murders, and looting. They were also frightened of what they saw in the sky. Minutes after the Northridge earthquake, people came to the streets and saw strange things in the sky, things that they had rarely seen before. Instead of waiting for the return of Batman to save their lives like in Hollywood movies, they quickly called 911 by payphone. They didn't call for help and transfer earthquake victims to the hospital or to report thefts or murders. They took refuge in the streets. They faced a terrifying and extraterrestrial problem after being survived the earthquake and the criminals. Maybe people faced both earthly and heavenly calamities at the same time. Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris doesn't represent France. A Rainy Day in New York doesn't represent the US. Woody Allen's Vicky Cristina Barcelona doesn't represent Spain. Paris is famous for its colorful sidewalks and cafes. New York is known for its skyscrapers and the glittering lights of the buildings on Lake Erie. Spain is famous for the Great Mosque of Cordoba and Prado National Museum in Madrid. But none of these postcards, which symbolize the identity of these cities for the people of the world, reflect the reality of life in them. When we talk about urbanization in the modern world, we think of commuters, skyscrapers, and neon lighting in shops. There are images of crowded but orderly streets of Tokyo, Shanghai with famous traditional and glass structures and buildings, and Hong Kong night lights. In these images, day and night in large and modern cities are not much different. These images are full of movements and colorful lights. In industrialized countries, large cities have a unique architecture and a large population. We can see very wide streets, large squares, and skyscrapers in these large cities. The architecture of cities has changed a lot throughout history. The new architecture of most cities is modeled after the architecture of Paris in the second half of the 19th century. There were riots and protests in Paris during that time. In the middle of 19th century, the architecture of Paris was completely changed due to the uprisings and protests. Meanwhile, Paris hosted numerous immigrants from all over France because of stagnation. After the French Revolution of 1848 and the start of Napoleon III's reign, the Protestant George Eugene Haussmann was responsible for the renovation of this chaotic, newly industrialized city of Europe. The Haussmann plan of Paris had many details, including wide tree-lined boulevards that could halt the rebellious acts in the narrow streets of Paris. These changes had consequences on urban lifestyle as well. The City of Lights embraces tourism, industry, fashion, exhibitions, cafes, and department stores. Paris nights were important to Parisians. Newly built boulevards, shops, theaters, and cafes changed the nightlife of Parisians. When Haussmann replaced the medieval architecture of Paris with modern architecture, gas lights were replaced by electric lamps and the lifestyle of Parisians and other European cities changed forever. Cities could never sleep under the new capitalist economy.
It's Jay Lawrence with radio station KFI. Ladies and gentlemen, if you just... what I can say...
On that cold January night in 1994, people in Northridge reported in multiple moments to the police and the local observatory that they saw a strange light beam in the sky. Angelinos thought that was an alien spaceship above their heads, just like the science fiction movies. They probably thought that aliens would open the hatch of the spaceship, then a ray of light would shine to the Earth, and strange aliens would get out one by one and finally would kill ordinary people with laser weapons. Nothing special happened at that night. It turned out that what had frightened people was nothing but the Milky Way. People could see the Milky Way after the blackout. Before the earthquake, they weren't able to see the Milky Way because of the lights in cities. In fact, people couldn't observe the sky due to the lighting at nights. The American Association for the Advancement of Science, with the data from First World Atlas, has stated that more than 80% of the world's population live under light-polluted skies. People are no longer able to fully observe the celestial objects such as moon and stars due to artificial lights at night. This atlas shows that more than 99% of the US and European populations live under light-polluted skies. Today, one-third of the world's population can see the Milky Way. Probably the future generations could only see the image of the beautiful Milky Way in the internet, books, and scientific documentaries. Before the expansion of artificial light pollution, people could easily see the Milky Way. Today, elderlies talk about the Milky Way as a memory. Now people go to different tourist attractions to see the Milky Way. People who live in urban areas escape from the light pollution of cities and go to the desert to see the sky full of stars with a group of friends or on nature tours. In the desert, they can see the twinkling of stars. They return to the cities after a short time and seek solace in light and noise pollution. Although we don't know what aliens in Hollywood movies imagine when they look at the dark side of the planet, if you look at these cities from the satellites, you will see masses of light covering a wide area of darkness. French astronaut Thomas Pesquet is one of the astronauts of the International Space Station. He published a picture of the night. In that picture, some parts of the Earth were much brighter than other parts. That bright spot was Belgium. Belgium is one of the smallest countries in Western Europe that covers an area of 30,000 square kilometers, which is a little bit larger than Kurdistan province in Iran. There are about 2.2 million bulbs, 186 bulbs per square mile, that illuminate Belgium at nights. If aliens want to reach out to Earth, they would follow that bright spot and reach Grand Place in Brussels. In reality, human life and nature are important. modern cities that are the center of attention for tourists and nightlife experience have become the main places that pollute natural light. Hong Kong is known as the most serious light pollution in the world. Moscow competes with St. Petersburg and produces 8 times more artificial lights than the world average. After Moscow, cities such as Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, Montreal in Canada, Buenos Aires in Argentina, and Chicago, Detroit, Denver, and Miami in the US are among the most important sources of light pollution. Why light pollution has been widespread? The excessive production and use of incandescent light bulb and super bright LEDs in the recent years have caused this new environmental pollution. This problem doesn't seem to be like other issues in the city, such as the bad smell of the garbage, the noise that damages our hearing and nerves, or the air pollution that causes respiratory and cardiac problems. So people don't take it seriously.
I drop off to sleep very easily, but after 2 hours I wake up and then it's difficult to go back to sleep. If it's one night, well, you can manage that. 2 nights is okay. But when it's 5 nights in a row, it's a bit much. And then you get very, very tired, not only physically, but also mentally. It makes me anxious or angry or, you know, frightened.
If we have a sleep disorder and look for the reason behind it, we will find a strange phenomenon. It's an issue that we haven't thought about it before. Light pollution is caused by artificial lights. Artificial lights have many effects on people's biological clock. Light pollution has turned sleep disorder into one of the common diseases of the century. The human body secretes melatonin during the night. Melatonin is mainly produced by pineal gland and regulated sleep-wake cycles. Melatonin is affected by light levels. If a person's sleeping environment has more than twice the light of the moon, this hormone will not be secreted.
The invasion of television into the home 50 years ago, and now computers and telephones, basically we need to shut that stuff off.
The circadian rhythm in biological clock produces about 10 to 15% of the genes in the human body, and its absence can cause irreparable damage. Today, thanks to the industrial world and modern medicine, melatonin tablets are available in pharmacies. Melatonin, which should be secreted naturally in the body, is produced by artificial methods and chemical drugs. People have to pay money to get melatonin tablets as well.
These days, a lot of Americans and people we know taking melatonin, but how safe is it?
80% of people have some sleep difficulty, from trouble falling asleep to waking up in the middle of the night to work the night shift and try to sleep during the day. Melatonin is safe. Again, we make it naturally. It's made by part of the brain called the pineal gland. What melatonin does is help to set our sleep-wake cycles. Mm-hmm. Melatonin release in your brain is the signal, hey, it's time to go to sleep. So for people who have trouble falling asleep, or people who have abnormal schedules, or even people who are trying to get over jet lag, a small dose of melatonin can help reset the sleep-wake cycle.
Is it good to trick your body like that, though, into falling asleep?
Thank you.
in the limelight.
Rather than funding the abuses at the detention center, U.S. lawmakers should heed calls by the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Human Rights to provide reparations to the victims of Guantanamo Bay Prison. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye noted, last month, the U.S. Senate passed the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, for 2024, an appropriations bill defining military priorities, and one that has consistently placed restrictions on remedies to the abuses at Guantanamo Bay. This year's bill, like many years prior, includes a prohibition on funds to close the infamous prison camp, a prohibition on funds to transfer the incarcerated men out of the prison, a prohibition on the transfer of detainees to Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, and the U.S., and a prohibition on modifying the prison. By supporting these measures, federal lawmakers have once again voted to perpetuate the problem of Guantanamo, the violence it is notorious for, and the collective responsibility of the Muslim men detained who have been rendered guilty until proven innocent. Despite the stated opposition from the White House, a veto of the bill seems unlikely. President Joe Biden, who has made past promises of closing the prison, has taken no action to initiate this process. Rather, he reportedly invested millions of dollars last year in renovating parts of the